At the turn of the century, when Susan Eisenberg was poetry editor for the now-defunct Nebraska Review in Omaha, she and fellow poet Aaron Blue realized something very important was missing from the literary landscape.
I was teaching a course in contemporary women's poetry, and I looked for an anthology. There were a couple, but they were sort of theme-driven. There was no anthology of the kind we wanted, which was sort of a comprehensive overview of the landscape of contemporary poetry by American women. That's what gave rise to it, just looking for a book that didn't exist.
That anthology, The Extraordinary Tide, New Poetry by American Women, came out in 2001 with over 400 poems, including some by the editors. We'll hear one by Susan Eisenberg, along with new poems from her third collection, Quiet City, published by Bookmark Press and honored in the 2016 Nebraska Book Awards. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air, and we talked at the University of Missouri, Kansas City after she led a workshop at the Writer's Place. Recently retired from Omaha's Creighton University, she had lost her artist mother, Edith Singer, the year before. I mentioned the anthology's striking cover art, a series of clothed and naked women standing with hands folded over their pubic area, when Susan Eisenberg revealed that was her mother's work.
Both my mother and brother are painters, and my brother has a series of paintings called the Jackies. And they are of a woman who was an abuse survivor. And that work of his inspired this work of my mother's.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Since your mother's painting was on the front of Extraordinary Tide, tell me about the artwork in Quiet City.
Well, actually, this one and also the cover of my first full-length collection, Muse, is my brother's work.
Oh, really? Both of them?
Yeah.
And what is his name?
His professional name is Michael David.
You know, it's not a very big collection, Quiet City, and yet it packs a powerful punch.
Oh, thank you.
There is a through line, that quiet desperation that so many of us suffer from on some level.
The title actually comes from the Weldon Keyes poem, To Build a Quiet City, in his mind, and I have a little bit from it as an epigraph to the book. A refuge permanent with trees that shade when all the other cities die and fade. And, you know, Keyes is generally a pretty dark poet, but he has this beautiful poem, To Build a Quiet City, in his mind that's ultimately a hopeful poem about it being possible to build this place despite the hurricanes of time. And that's more the way in which I was thinking of it. But I think when you're assembling a collection, I found this when Muse came out, I was sort of surprised when, you know, people do the blurbs and they send you these things to read. And I didn't see lots of things that were happening in the book as a collection that other people saw. And I think that probably is happening with this book too. You work on the poems and you assemble them in a way that seems to make some kind of sense. And those through lines, as you put it, are not things that I consciously think about.
Once you put them together, they start to link themselves somehow. It's so strange, isn't it?
It is. I mean, there are people that do collections that they conceive as a whole,
right,
and they work on them that way. I saw the wonderful Linda Beards read many years ago, and she was talking about, at least for one collection, she actually drew out like a diagram of the arc of the book and thought of that. That's not the way that I have worked, at least so far. And I guess on the one hand, it's surprising. On the other hand, they're all things that you're thinking about and experiencing. And so in some way, I guess they're naturally connected.
You may not have had a through line, but there are poems about women being a little fearful. There's that sense of wanting to hang on to what you got, even though it's not the healthiest or the best thing in the world. So
yeah.
You have some poetry in Quiet City that I think looks back to a time in your mother's life or some character who is a mother. I won't jump to the conclusion that it's your mother. And so I'll get you to start with Via Negativa. And in the notes in the back of this, it says that this is inspired by Robert Hass's magnificent poem, The World is Will and Representation.
Okay. Via Negativa. I'm sure they meant no harm, the good Quakers, believing as they did in sorrow and redemption, when they imagined into being Eastern State, the world's first true penitentiary, where for decades prisoners never saw the sky, lived in silence so complete it must have been palpable as the stone floors of their cells. My father, too, believed in the power of true regret and sentenced my mother sometimes to weeks of silence. How cheery he was with my brother and me in those long hours after dinner. The meat and potatoes square meals of the early 60s I could never swallow. Later, when she thought we were sleeping, I'd hear her through the thin bedroom walls. "Please just say something. I'm sorry. You were right. I was wrong." I knew even then what I had heard in her voice was fear. His steps when he left for work in the morning were soft as the muffled tread of the Eastern State guards in their felt slippers, the wheels of their carts wrapped in cotton wool. Locked in for years, the petty thieves and drunks mostly went mad, though some learned, as my mother did, to speak whatever words might release them into the world of sound and the small, necessary consolations of even the coldest human speech.
Via Negativa, that's from the collection Quiet City, poems by Susan Eisenberg, and this is New Letters on the Air. I remember when I started reading this poem, we're starting off with the good Quakers and then the penitentiary, and then it becomes such a personal poem about the mother and father and this lack of communication. So I like the way that it unfurls.
Thank
and
you.
Kind of surprises you in the direction that it takes. Are these poems written over a vast amount of time? Because, you know, it's been a while since you had 2002, your book Muse came out.
I don't think any of these were written before Muse came out. I think they were all written in the interim. But I was teaching full time during those years. And so there would be years when maybe I finished two new poems, and then I'd be on sabbatical and I'd finish eight new poems. So it's hard for me to remember exactly when these were done. I think Via Negativa is one of the first poems that's in the book that I finished. And
yeah,
a lot of my poems are written, I think, of sort of by accretion. I'll have a few lines over here dealing with something and a journal entry over there about something else, and then they come together as a poem. It's the rare poem that I sit down and go from the first line to the last. I don't think too many people work that way, actually.
I don't think so either.
Yeah.
But occasionally people get a gift that way.
That's true. There's a poem in Muse that I woke up one morning and there it was, and it didn't get that much changed.
Are you a morning writer? Is that part of your process, or do you just write when you find a moment?
I always tell my students, do what I say, not what I do, because I have terrible writing habits. I go in spurts. There have been periods when I prefer first thing in the morning, get up and work. There's other times working late at night. One of the things I found I sort of had to do when I was teaching full time is write when I could. Many of the new poems that I've written since Via Negativa came out of a period when I was living with my mother for about 6 weeks when she was very ill. She was dying. And during that time, I developed a habit of just making quick notes on my phone and just writing short fragments that way. And then weeks later, when I went back home, I assembled them all and typed them all up, and I had all this material to work with. So I've worked different ways depending on the circumstances. And I'm about to figure out a new way to work because I just retired from full-time teaching. And so now I suddenly have freedom to write when I want to and time. And so I haven't exactly figured out what my schedule is going to be, but I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah. That's so funny that you would use your phone. So rather than sit down with pen and paper, you would text yourself?
No, I wrote and I used a little app called Evernote for a lot of it. But then a lot of it were texts, but they weren't to myself. I would text my husband or I would text my brother or a friend or something. And I kept all of those. It was a very chaotic and difficult time. And finding a notebook and sitting down even briefly just didn't seem doable, whereas I constantly had my phone on me because stuff was always happening. And so it just was more natural to quickly do it in the phone.
You're the first writer I've talked to that has used their phone that way or has told me about it. Yeah. You know, one of the things that I was struck by is that you are not afraid of dealing with tough subjects, even from way back. In fact, one of the three poems that's included of yours in The Extraordinary Tide, New Poetry by American Women, is one about a son. And you have several poems actually in Quiet City about a son as well. But I thought we would go back in time to art. And there's a place in here where it's language we can't have on the radio, so we'll have to bleep you. But I thought I'd have you read
this.
Never
been bleeped.
It's just such a powerful poem. I thought I'd have you read it.
Okay. So it carries an epigraph from Adam Zagajewski, which reads, "Ordinary isn't possible anymore. Art." In the teacher's lounge, the tall, pretty Irish woman tells me her anorexic daughter's been hospitalized 2 years. She's 15. Their deaths are something she can only laugh about. I sip tepid coffee, tell her about the afternoon I watched deputies cuff my son, pat him down against a black and white while he invited them to suck his him in the ass, and cried. Today, I teach figurative constructions to high school juniors signed up for creative writing in hope of an easy grade. I quote Wallace Stevens, wonder what metaphor I can use to find the unities in this. What was he like raging by that car? Was the sun fiery, the police faces stone? Soon, I'll speak to English teachers from four schools about the value of art and imagination, to students whose 12-step stories of locked wards and halfway house failures I've listened to all week. I don't know what to say about these stories, how to explain that they come to me daily as if I wear some sign. And I don't know what it means as I watch them laughing in school hallways, slamming their lockers, tonguing each other in a sweet approximation of love. When I call him at the hospital, my son tells me a story. A friend has died. The rumor is someone Scotchgarded his dope. Forgive me if this seems extreme. I don't know how to make things ordinary anymore, though I dress and go to work each day as if the world were ordinary, as if our lives might unfurl easily as some well-mannered plot, carefully rounded characters strolling bucolic paths, safe beneath lucid trees, their steps measured and graceful as the orderly progression of their lives, a shapeliness such as no one might imagine anymore.
Art, included in New Poetry by American Women, the anthology called The Extraordinary Tide, that was edited by Susan Eisenberg and Aaron Blue. You know, it was so interesting because there's that character trying to make everything normal, and yet her personal life with the son, who's out of control, and then students who are in difficult situations and then trying to find that normal. I like that juxtaposition there.
You know, I think for those of us who love art and believe in art, you come up against, at least I certainly have, the notion of the limits of it. You like to think that it doesn't have limits in what it can do for us, but there are some situations where it sort of seems fruitless. Somebody's got that line about the blood of the children in the streets was like the blood of the children in the streets. Clearly, there are limits to metaphor. As much as those of us who spend our lives doing this believe in it, there are limits.
So were you in a teaching situation like this at one
time? Yeah, I did some artists in the schools teaching.
Well, I take it that you've had difficulty with a son, because a son comes up in Quiet City, too, where it's a struggle.
Well, I have two sons. And I guess I would just like to say, without appearing to be coy about it, the truth of it is that my poems are fiction. And like all fiction, they draw on bits of my experience, bits of other people's experiences that I know, and imagination. And I would hate for anyone to assume that anything in my poems is directly autobiographical or biographical, because it's not. Now, having said that, I have two sons. They're grown men now, and two grandsons. So,
well, that's what I was trying to get at. Is a lot of your work fiction, or is it autobiographical? Because you can't tell, especially when there's so many first-person poems. And it's always interesting to find out if somebody is writing as a way of dealing with difficulties or if they're writing in this totally imaginary world.
I don't think there is a purely imaginary world. Everything you can imagine comes from something. Something you saw, something you experienced, something someone you know experienced, something you read. And I think that the intimacy of the lyric form and the first-person speaker leads readers to feel that the poet is directly relaying her or his experience.
That it's confessional. Yeah.
Right. And I think it's important to know that facts and truth are not the same. So while I would say, have I felt the sorts of things as a mother about children that some of the mothers in the poems here feel? Well, sure. But does it mean that the facts presented in the poems are things that happened either to my children or me? Maybe, maybe not. I'm not telling. You know, there's combinations of things. And, there's a story I heard. I wasn't present for it, that Phil Levine was giving a reading once, and he read some poem in which the speaker talked about something that had happened to the sister. Very moving poem. And the story goes that a woman came up to him after the reading and said, "Mr. Levine, I just loved your work and I loved that poem so much. And how is your sister?" And Levine said, "I don't have a sister. I made that up." And the woman was furious. She felt she'd been lied to. And in a way, I don't blame her, right? Because we sort of want it both ways. The poem intends to convince. It intends that as you read it, you believe that you are reading a genuine experience and you buy it. And then on the other hand, it's like, well, yeah, but don't expect me to tell you that it's real. So I get that.
You have an ekphrastic poem about art in here that refers to William Merritt Chase. You also have a couple of poems about writers, Truman Capote, and then Tennessee Williams. You can just think of some of his plays, because there's somebody who took his life and transformed it into something else, taking different facts and putting them in, but it's not a true representation of his life. Let's have you read one of these. I particularly like Red Goose.
Oh, thank you. Okay, so this has an epigraph. It's a quote from Tennessee Williams about this job that he had in a shoe factory called Red Goose Shoes, and he says, "The lowliest of my assigned duties was the one I liked most, dusting off the sample shoes in three brightly colored sample rooms each morning." The poem is called Red Goose. Still just Tom at 30. He's one more unskilled worker, clocking in and out 6 days each week. His life's brief measure of hours, lost to work numbing as the old-time sermons his mother drags him to. Payback for ungallant Sunday hangovers. The world's largest shoe factory is a vast, cacophonous machine. Rough thunder of metal presses, insistent as migraine. Shrill of whistles that signal time to come, to go, time to eat, to stop eating, until he wants to retch, to lie for hours in a shuttered room, chilled compresses smoothing the lines from his forehead. But that's his sister's luxury, and so he hides out each morning among the dazzling showroom mirrors and the high-polished shoes on their stacked glass terraces, dusting and dreaming. Was he plotting already his escape, his desertion of Rose? I like to think he was, that he imagined perhaps a landlocked romantic's Cuba, brown-skinned boys in straw hats, soft lilt of Spanish on the air, Alma, mi corazón, machetes flashing hot equatorial sun. Beyond the fields, a warm gator green ocean, white sailboats like doves tracing the horizon.
That's Red Goose from Quiet City, poems by Susan Eisenberg, her tribute to Tennessee Williams. Hey, I wanted to ask you, because you got your MFA in creative writing at Vermont College of Fine Arts, were you actually in Vermont, or was this one of those that you do from afar?
It's a low residency.
A low residency.
And I was living in Nebraska at the time, and we would go to Vermont every 6 months. It was wonderful. The thing about a low residency program, since they draw faculty from all over, you're not limited to people who can live there and work there. You have the opportunity to work with some of the best, in my case, poets in the country, and I did. And it was also the experience itself. You would go there for, I think it was 12 days or 2 weeks, I can't remember. It was very, very intensive. It was sort of like a cult, you know, of writers and poets. And it was wonderful. There'd be all these readings and lectures and just the conversations you'd have with people. And you'd workshop. And then when you weren't there, you would work one-on-one for these months with the poet that you were studying with. And I had gone there specifically because I wanted to study with David Wojahn. And I was so in awe of him that I didn't even attempt to sign up to study with him at first, even though that's why I'd gone there.
And then finally you felt brave enough?
You know, every time I saw him, I felt like I was so goofy because I loved his work. I had his work virtually memorized. And Aaron Blue and I were students together, and we used to sit around and say things like, I would give my left arm to write like Wojahn. I mean, this is how it was. And so finally, one day I had to say to him, I think I called him Mr. Wojahn, I just have to apologize to you. I want you to know I'm actually a very serious poet, and I'm acting so silly every time I see you. It's just because I'm nervous and I admire your work so much. And he was just so lovely and kind about it in response, and he was great to work with.
Oh, that's good.
I can't believe I just told that story on the radio. It's mortifying.
Well, you know, I think these poetic mentors are important people. You won the 2014 Marie Sandoz Award from the Nebraska Library Association. What was that for?
It was for my poetry. It's for contributions to the life of the book and literature in Nebraska. And you don't know when you're nominated for it. It just comes as a complete surprise. And that was lovely. And it was especially sweet because, like most writers, I love libraries. And so to get an award from the Library Association was very meaningful.
And now you've gotten some recognition from a very famous Nebraska poet, Ted Kooser, former U.S. Poet Laureate, who chose one of your poems from this book to be in his column, American Life and Poetry. Did you get to deal with him much while you were living in Nebraska?
Well, I met Ted before he got all that recognition, and he's a lovely person. So I did know him a little bit.
Well, the poem that he picked to put in his column, we should have you read it.
All right. Mornings. Before the train screamed him through tunnels to his windowless office, the idiots he had to sir, my father needed a space without us. So in a crack of light from the bathroom, he dressed, held his shoes by two fingers, and left us sleeping. That walk to the diner, the last stars fading out, the sky lightening from black to blue to white, was his time. He walked in all weather, let each season touch him all over, lifted his face to rain and sun. He liked to watch the old houses stir awake and nod to the woman in her slippers on 27th, smoking as she strolled her little mutt. To step back smooth as Fred Astaire from the paperboy's wild toss. Milk bottles sweated on doorsteps, sweet cream on top, and once he lifted a quart from its wire basket, drank it down beneath our neighbor's winking porch light, and left the empty on the stoop.
Mornings from Quiet City by Susan Eisenberg, and it was also chosen to be in Ted Kooser's column, An American Life and Poetry, and this is New Letters on the Air. I can see why that appealed to Ted, knowing his own work and how he shows these glimpses of life. I thought about having you read a poem dedicated to your husband. This one is not at the end of the collection, but it's close. For a long time, I have wanted to write a poem about happiness.
You know, I often close readings with this poem.
Do you really?
Yeah, because, you know, reading all this dark stuff, I think, okay, I got to do something. My husband keeps telling me that I need to write a funny poem. He says, you know, you're sort of funny in person. You need to write one. So it's one of my goals, but they're actually hard to write, funny poems and happy love poems. Okay. This carries an epigraph from Keyes, "A little at a time and slow is best." Across the street, ghostly hoists and tractors slowly dry beside the skeleton of a new high-rise. Storms have rinsed the summer air of the day's brute humidity, and now, redolent of wet grass, it lifts the red perfume of my geraniums from their clay pots. The city's quiet. The hush of traffic along Pacific Street, awash in motor oil and vapor light below us, almost the only sound. Leaves drip from the sugar maples as one by one our neighbors' windows illuminate the facing apartments, gold squares in a blue-black quilt.
Nice. You know, I also liked that one because you mentioned the city's quiet in here. How come you didn't place it last in the book?
I wanted to close with that image of the mother that closes the actual final poem. A lot of the threads in that poem speak to a lot of the things happening in the collection, so it felt like the one to close it with.
Yeah. Well, let's have you read the very last poem.
Okay. This has an epigraph, and excuse my terrible French pronunciation, from Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, which reads, "At the summit, you will find yourselves united with all those who, from every direction, have made this same ascent." And the poem is called "Everything That Rises." Suspended and swaying from steel cables, the bridge seems to listen for some word from the river. A ribbon of hammered nickel, you write. See how it shines. You've made love with your husband, and now even the indigo skyline, still vague out your window, seems to shift in its sleep. It's nothing like the childhood landscape you recall, the cool, dark sand of Brooklyn beneath splintering boardwalks, first kisses, feral cats gliding like shades through the steam rising from the subway to catch the wind. The wind broadcasting the bright sounds of the Temptations and Four Tops from transistors all over town. You don't want to know, just blocks from here, three tweakers are cutting up a comrade they believe holds out on them. Don't want to imagine the silvery gleam of tape gagging his mouth. His slow death, 10 minutes' drive from where your son's child rises, wet and smiling from his crib. Because she knows your habits, your mother calls from her pink condo beside the ocean. She swears your dead father was there when she woke, that her enormous cockatoos, don't you dare laugh, are intelligent, that when they heard her stir, they began to sing. You picture her faded nightgown, the sultry air troubling the curtains, how she stands, phone in hand, watching the wide gulf. A lowering astonishment of yellow moon.
Susan Eisenberg in 2016, reading from Quiet City, published by Bookmark Press. The Creighton University professor emerita now writes and teaches summer workshops at the University of Iowa. For links, visit newletters.org, a production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC. Today's show was produced with Mackenzie Callahan, Claire Verbeck, Emma Fernhout, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.